From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. There is a moment in almost every investigation like this one when the story that seemed so clear, so heartbreaking, so straightforward, begins to quietly come apart at the seams. For the detectives who responded to a quiet street in Oceanside, California, on the morning of March 14, 2003, that moment came sooner than most. Edward Hartwell was standing in the driveway when the first patrol unit arrived, his arms wrapped around himself against the cool coastal air, his face a portrait of anguish. His wife, he told the responding officers, had been attacked inside their home. There had been an intruder, he said. He had come home to find her. The officers moved past him and into the house. And what they found in the master bedroom would set in motion more than 2 years of investigation, courtroom testimony, and ultimately, a jury's firm and final answer to a question that Edward Hartwell had tried very hard to make disappear. What really happened to Roberta Hartwell that morning? To know Roberta Hartwell is to understand, at least a little, what was lost. She was 44 years old in the spring of 2003. A woman her friends and family described to investigators and to reporters from the San Diego Union-Tribune as someone who filled every room she entered with a particular kind of warmth. The kind that is not performative, not curated for an audience, but simply a natural extension of who a person is. She had grown up in the San Diego area, had worked for years as a dental hygienist, and was known in the community for her reliability, her humor, and the genuine interest she took in the lives of the people around her. She was a mother. She was a neighbor who remembered birthdays and brought food when someone was sick. She was, by every account gathered in the aftermath of her death, the kind of person whose absence leaves a hole that does not fill. She and Edward had been married for 11 years. They lived in a subdivision in Oceanside, one of those neighborhoods that real estate listings describe with words like established and family-friendly. Streets lined with tidy yards and cul-de-sacs, the kind of place where people feel safe because the houses look like safety, because the lawns are mowed and the cars are new. It was, in every outward appearance, a comfortable life. Whether it was also a happy one would become a central and deeply contested question in the months ahead. By the time forensic investigators completed their initial walkthrough of the Hartwell home that morning, several things had already begun to trouble the lead detectives assigned to the case by the Oceanside Police Department. Edward told investigators that he had left the house early, before Roberta was awake, he said, to run errands. He returned, he explained, to find the front door unlocked, which struck him as unusual. He went inside, called for his wife, received no answer, and made his way to the master bedroom where he found her. He said he did not touch anything. He said he called 911 immediately. The 911 call itself, which prosecutors would later play for the jury, was noted by investigators as sounding, in the words of one detective's report cited during the trial, notably controlled for someone who had just discovered their spouse's body. That observation alone, prosecutors were careful to note, means nothing in isolation. Grief manifests differently in every human being, and shock can produce responses that look, to an outside observer, like calm. But it was one thread. And in this case, the threads, once investigators began pulling at them, did not stop coming. Forensic examination of the scene revealed that Roberta Hartwell had died from blunt force trauma. She had been struck multiple times with a heavy object in what the medical examiner concluded, according to court records, was a sustained and deliberate attack. The staging of the bedroom, investigators noted, showed signs consistent with what forensic experts sometimes call a secondary crime scene presentation. Meaning, according to testimony presented at trial, that certain elements appeared to have been arranged or disturbed in ways that did not align with the physical evidence of where and how the violence had actually occurred. Drawers had been pulled open, items were scattered, but the pattern of that scattering, forensic analysts testified, was inconsistent with the movement of an intruder searching hurriedly through a space. It was, they argued, inconsistent with the story of a home invasion. There was no sign of forced entry. None of the doors, none of the windows. Edward had said the front door was unlocked when he returned. But Roberta, her friends told detectives, was meticulous about locking the house when she was alone. Several of her closest friends volunteered this detail independently, without prompting. It was simply something about her, something everyone who knew her knew. Investigators began reconstructing Edward Hartwell's movements on the morning of March 14th, and what they found introduced what prosecutors would describe at trial as critical and irreconcilable inconsistencies in his account. Surveillance footage from a gas station and a grocery store, subpoenaed by investigators in the days following the murder, showed Edward's vehicle during a window of time that, according to prosecutors, did not square with the timeline he had provided to police. Cell phone records, obtained through a court-authorized warrant, placed his phone, and, by inference, its owner, in a location and sequence of locations that further complicated his stated account of his morning's movements. The records did not place him somewhere exculpatory. They placed him, prosecutors argued, in a pattern consistent with someone who had been at or near the residence during the time the medical examiner estimated Roberta had been killed. The medical examiner's estimated time of death, established through body temperature, lividity, and other standard forensic markers, was a range that preceded the time Edward claimed to have left the house. Investigators also developed information, through interviews with people in the Hartwell social circle, suggesting that the marriage had been under strain. Financial pressures had mounted in the preceding year. There were accounts, offered by multiple witnesses and cited in court records, of arguments, serious ones, about money, about the future. Prosecutors would later argue that Edward Hartwell had come to see his wife not as his partner but as an obstacle, and that a life insurance policy on Roberta, a policy, court records confirm, that named Edward as the sole beneficiary, had become, in the prosecution's framing, a motive. Edward Hartwell was arrested in June of 2003, approximately 3 months after Roberta's death. He was charged with first-degree murder. He maintained his innocence. His defense attorneys argued that the evidence against him was circumstantial, that the investigation had been driven by a rush to judgment, and that the real killer, the intruder their client had described from the very beginning, had never been adequately pursued by investigators who had made up their minds too quickly and too completely. It is worth pausing here, as any honest telling of a story like this one must, to acknowledge that those arguments were not frivolous on their face. Circumstantial cases require careful scrutiny. Investigators do sometimes develop tunnel vision. The absence of forced entry is not, by itself, proof of guilt. The prosecution's case was built, piece by patient piece, from the forensic evidence, the timeline reconstructions, the cell phone and surveillance records, the testimony of the medical examiner, and the accounts of friends and acquaintances who described both the state of the marriage and the details, small but, the prosecution argued, significant, that undermined Edwards. And Edward Hartwell, sitting at the defense table, was a man who had not yet been convicted of anything, who was, in the eyes of the law, presumed innocent. The jury would weigh all of it. That is what juries do. The trial of Edward Hartwell opened in the spring of 2005 inches San Diego Superior Court, and it lasted several weeks. Version of events. An expert in crime scene analysis, called by the prosecution, walked the jury through the physical evidence in the bedroom and offered the opinion, based on blood pattern analysis and the positioning of the victim and the surrounding furniture, that the scene had been altered after the fact, that someone had moved things, rearranged things, in an effort to make the room look. The forensic testimony was particularly extensive, like something it was not. Defense attorneys challenged this testimony vigorously on cross-examination, questioning the expert's methodology and the degree of certainty that could reasonably be claimed from blood pattern evidence. It was, by all accounts, a genuine fight, the kind of adversarial exchange that the system is designed to produce. The life insurance policy was introduced into evidence. Prosecutors argued that it represented a financial incentive, not a small one. Defense attorneys countered that married couples carry life insurance on each other as a matter of ordinary prudence, and that the existence of a policy proves nothing about the intentions of the person who holds it. The cell phone records were walked through in detail. The surveillance footage was shown. The timeline was laid out, segment by segment, with prosecutors arguing that each data point taken together formed a picture that simply could not be reconciled with Edward Hartwell's account of his own mourning. And then there was the testimony of Roberta's friends, women who had known her for years, who spoke about her habits, her character, her marriage, and who described with evident and unfeigned grief the small specific detail of a woman who always, always locked her door. After deliberating for several days, the jury returned a verdict of guilty on the charge of first-degree murder. The finding carried with it a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole, which the judge imposed. In the courtroom that day, according to reporting by the San Diego Union-Tribune, members of Roberta's family were present. Edward Hartwell, according to the same reporting, showed little visible reaction as the verdict was read. He continued to maintain his innocence. The legal process did not end with the verdict. It rarely does in cases of this magnitude, and there is a reason for that. The appellate courts exist precisely to catch errors, to ensure that convictions rest on sound legal foundations, and Edward Hartwell's attorneys pursued that avenue with commitment, and with the specific arguments they believed gave their client the strongest grounds for review. The appeals raised questions about evidentiary rulings made during the trial, challenges to the admissibility of certain forensic testimony, arguments about the instructions given to the jury, and broader claims that the cumulative weight of the prosecution's presentation had been prejudicial in ways that denied Hartwell a fair trial. These were not trivial objections in the abstract. They were the kinds of arguments that appellate courts take seriously and examine carefully. The California appellate courts examined them, and they disagreed. The conviction was upheld. The reasoning, as documented in the appellate record, found that the trial had been conducted within proper legal bounds, that the evidentiary rulings challenged by the defense had been within the discretion of the trial court, and that the evidence presented was sufficient to support the jury's finding beyond a reasonable doubt. Edward Hartwell's conviction stands. He is serving his sentence in the California state prison system. There is something that lingers in a case like this one, something that does not resolve itself as neatly as a verdict, something that the legal process can adjudicate but cannot quite dissolve. It is the image of Roberta Hartwell in the neighborhood she lived in, the life she was living, the ordinary Tuesday morning she woke to that became the last morning she would ever see. She was not a person who existed to be the victim of a crime story. She was a dental hygienist who made people laugh, who brought food to sick neighbors, who locked her door when she was alone inside her house because she was, by the accounts of everyone who loved her, a careful and sensible woman who believed she was safe. She was 44 years old. The people who knew her best, the friends who sat with investigators and testified in courtrooms and carried her memory through the long years of a process that can grind as much as it resolves, those people did not need a verdict to know who Roberta was. They knew her. They knew what she was worth. And the absence of her in the world is not something a sentence, however just and however final, has the power to repair. What the process offered, what 12 citizens of San Diego County delivered after weeks of testimony and days of deliberation, was accountability. Not healing. Not restoration. Accountability. The finding that what happened to Roberta Hartwell was not a mystery left open, not a tragedy without a cause, but a crime with a perpetrator who was found, tried, and held responsible. It is, in the end, the most that justice in its formal and human sense can offer. And for the family of Roberta Hartwell, who waited for it through 2 years of investigation and trial and appeal, it was, at least, something real. Our next case takes us to Salem, Oregon. There was frost on the pavement outside the Dome building that January night, and the man who found him almost didn't stop. It was around 9:30 in the evening on January 17, 1989, when a passerby noticed something wrong near the entrance to the Oregon Department of Corrections headquarters in Salem, a figure on the ground, motionless in the cold. Michael Frank, the director of Oregon's entire corrections system, was lying in the parking lot, stabbed. He was 42 years old. By the time help arrived, he was gone. What followed would become one of the largest, most complicated, and most disputed murder investigations in Oregon history. A case that would consume years of courtroom time, generate thousands of pages of legal record, and leave behind questions that some people to this day refuse to stop asking. But at its center always was a man, a public servant who had come to Oregon with ambition, with idealism, and with what many who knew him described as a genuine desire to change something broken. Michael Frank had not grown up dreaming of prisons. He had grown up in New Mexico, one of a family of close siblings, a man shaped by the American Southwest, its landscape, its sense of space, its cultural complexity. He was educated, articulate, and by the time he arrived in Oregon in 1987 to take the job of corrections director under Governor Neil Goldschmidt, he had already developed a reputation as a reformer. Oregon's prison system at the time was burdened by overcrowding, by accusations of internal corruption, and by a drug problem that reached, according to investigators, well into the institutions themselves. Contraband moved through the system with troubling ease. Frank knew it. He talked about it publicly and in the closed rooms where policy gets made. He was, by all accounts, pushing hard. Friends and colleagues remembered him as direct, sometimes uncomfortably so. He did not soften what he saw. He had a wife, a family, and the kind of professional intensity that can make a person powerful and, occasionally, enemies. On the night he died, he had stayed late at the office. That much was documented. What brought him out into the parking lot, into the cold, and into proximity with whoever killed him? That was the question that set the investigation in motion and kept it moving for years. The discovery that evening on January 17th triggered an immediate and massive response. The Oregon State Police took the lead, understanding from the outset that the victim's position, Director of Corrections, in a building that housed sensitive records about Oregon's prisons and the people in them, made this no ordinary homicide. The crime scene was processed carefully. Frank had been stabbed, the medical examiner would determine, multiple times. There was no sign of robbery as a primary motive, though some accounts noted his vehicle appeared to have been searched. The investigation moved quickly outward from that parking lot, pulling in threads from Frank's professional world, his reform efforts, the volatile ecosystem of Oregon's prisons, and the people connected to all of it. In the months that followed, the state police conducted what investigators later described as one of the most extensive interviews and canvassing operations in Oregon history. Hundreds of people were spoken to. Tips came in. The investigation scope was enormous and at times unwieldy. There were theories, some of them quite dramatic, circulating in the press and in Salem's political corridors about why a corrections director might be killed and by whom. Organized crime, corrupt guards, drug networks. None of those theories, prosecutors would ultimately argue, led where some had hoped or feared. They led instead to a man named Frank Gable. Frank Gable was 30 years old when he was arrested in connection with Michael Frank's murder. He had a significant criminal history, theft, drugs, the kind of accumulated record that tends to place a person in proximity to systems of incarceration and the informal economies that operate around them. He was not, in 1989, a person of standing or resources. He was someone who moved through the margins, who knew people who knew people, and who had, According to prosecutors, connections to the drug trade that ran into and out of Oregon's prisons. The very world that Michael Frank had been working to disrupt. What brought Gable to investigators' attention was a combination of witness accounts and his own alleged statements. Multiple individuals told investigators, according to court records and subsequent reporting, that Gable had made comments about Frank, comments that, in retrospect, prosecutors argued took on the character of threats or foreknowledge. Several witnesses placed Gable in or near Salem around the time of the murder. The investigation, after its long initial sweep, began to converge on him in a way that convinced the Marion County District Attorney's Office to move forward with charges. Gable was charged with aggravated murder. The trial, which began in 1991 inches Marion County, was by any measure a major event in Oregon's legal history. The courtroom was full. The stakes were plain. On one side, prosecutors presented what they argued was a coherent, if largely circumstantial, case. Witness testimony placing Gable near the scene, accounts of statements he had allegedly made, and evidence tying him to the drug underworld that had reason to fear Frank's reforms. On the other side, the defense argued that Frank Gable was innocent, that the witnesses against him were unreliable, that they had their own interests and their own reasons to cooperate with prosecutors, and that the state had fastened onto Gable because the real answers to Michael Frank's murder were too complicated, too politically dangerous to pursue. The jury deliberated and returned a verdict of guilty. Frank Gable was convicted of aggravated murder in the death of Michael Frank and sentenced to life in prison. It was 1991. The case, for many Oregonians, appeared to be closed. It was not closed, not remotely. What followed the conviction was one of the longest and most contested appellate processes in Oregon memory. Gable maintained, consistently and loudly, that he had not killed Michael Frank. His family maintained it. Over time, his case attracted the attention of journalists, legal advocates, and eventually some of the most rigorous scrutiny that a conviction can face outside a courtroom. Questions were raised, serious, documented questions, about the witnesses who had testified against him. Some of those witnesses later recanted portions of their testimony, or raised issues about the circumstances under which they had spoken to investigators. There were allegations that some witnesses had received benefits, formal or informal, for their cooperation. The scrutiny intensified when members of Frank's own family, including his brother Kevin Frank, began publicly questioning whether the right man had been convicted. Kevin Frank became perhaps the most prominent voice arguing that the investigation had gone wrong, that there were elements of his brother's death connected to corruption within Oregon's prison system that had never been properly examined, and that Frank Gable was not responsible. It was an unusual and deeply human spectacle, a murder victim's brother fighting for the freedom of the man convicted of that murder. Kevin Frank's advocacy added a layer of moral complexity to the case that could not easily be dismissed. Oregon courts took the appeals seriously. The case went through multiple rounds of post-conviction review. Gable's legal team argued at various stages that he had received ineffective assistance of counsel, that exculpatory evidence had been withheld, and that the witness testimony that had convicted him was constitutionally unreliable. These arguments were carefully examined, and ultimately they did not prevail, not in the way Gable and his supporters had hoped. The Oregon Supreme Court, in reviewing the case through the years of litigation, ultimately upheld the conviction. The court's analysis, as reported and documented in legal records, found that the evidence presented at trial, while substantially dependent on witness testimony, was sufficient to support the jury's finding. The issues raised in post-conviction proceedings, troubling as some of them were, did not, in the court's assessment, rise to the level required to overturn a jury's verdict. Frank Gable remained in prison. There is a particular kind of silence that settles over a case like this, not the silence of resolution, but the silence of exhaustion. The courts had spoken. The legal machinery had run its full course, and yet the noise persisted because the questions that had been raised about witness reliability, about the investigation's direction, about what Michael Frank's work had stirred up in the world of Oregon corrections, those questions did not have a neat judicial answer. They had only the verdict and the years. What the documented record establishes with clarity is this. Michael Frank was murdered on January 17, 1989, in the parking lot of his own department's headquarters. Frank Gable was tried by a jury of his peers in Marion County, Oregon, and that jury found him guilty of that murder. The Oregon Supreme Court ultimately sustained that finding after years of appellate review. Those are the adjudicated facts, and they carry the full weight of the legal process. What the documented record also shows, and what makes this case something more than a simple closed chapter, is that the path from crime to conviction was not a smooth one, that the witnesses who carried the prosecution's case were not without complications, and that the doubt expressed by some, including members of the victim's own family, was not manufactured from nothing. It was real doubt, documented and expressed through legitimate channels. It simply did not, in the end, undo what 12 jurors had decided. Frank Gable was still incarcerated as of the resolution of his major appellate battles, his life in prison a consequence of the Marion County jury's verdict and the appellate court's refusal to disturb it. Michael Frank's family has carried the weight of this case for decades in different ways. There are those among them who have made peace, in whatever sense peace is available in the aftermath of violent loss. There are those who have not. His brother Kevin spent years on the outside of the official record, pushing on doors that mostly stayed closed, asking questions that did not receive satisfying answers. That kind of grief, the complicated grief that cannot simply accept the official resolution, is its own burden, and it deserves to be seen clearly. What is perhaps most striking, looking back from a distance, is how much this case was always about something larger than one parking lot in Salem. Michael Frank had walked into a system in disorder and had started pulling on threads. He was, by his own public statements and by the accounts of those who worked with him, genuinely concerned about what drugs and corruption were doing inside Oregon's prisons. Not as an abstraction, but as a daily, corrosive reality that hurt inmates, corrupted staff, and degraded the institutions themselves. He believed those things could be changed. Whether his work along those lines had anything to do with his death, whether the drug underworld connected to those prisons had any role in what happened in that parking lot, was a question the prosecution answered one way, the defense answered another, and history has not fully settled. What is not in dispute is that a man who devoted himself to public service, who believed in the possibility of institutional reform, who had a family that loved him and colleagues who respected him, that man was killed. Stabbed and left in the cold on an Oregon winter night, at the place where he worked, at an age when he still had so much work ahead of him. In the annals of Oregon crime, the Frank case sits in a particular category. Not the simple, solved cases that time buries cleanly, but the ones that leave a residue, the ones that get written about in newspapers 20 years later, that generate documentary projects, that draw law students and journalists who want to understand not just what happened, but how a society decides what happened. Those cases matter because they test the system, not just the correctional system Frank was trying to fix, but the judicial system that tried and convicted his alleged killer, and the democratic system that has to decide what to do when citizens keep raising their hands and saying, "Wait, are we sure?" The official answer, confirmed by Oregon's highest court, is yes. The jury was sure. The appellate courts found no sufficient reason to say otherwise. Frank Gable was convicted of the aggravated murder of Michael Frank, and that conviction stands. But the tide that rose around this case, the investigations, the recantations, the family advocacy, the years of legal combat, that tide has never entirely gone out. It laps at the edges of the official record, as it sometimes does in cases where the truth has been decided, but not everyone believes the decision. Michael Frank deserved better than a parking lot in January. He deserved the rest of the life he had been building and the reforms he had been pushing for and the future he had imagined. He was, by everything documented about him, a person who was trying to make something better. That much is not in dispute. That much is simply true. His name is on the record now, the crime reports, the trial transcripts, the appellate decisions, the journalism. It is a complicated record, as life tends to produce. But somewhere inside it, if you look past the competing theories and the legal arguments and the decades of noise, you can still find the person, a man from New Mexico in Oregon doing his job, until he wasn't. Our next case takes us to Gwinnett County, Georgia. There is a moment, investigators would later say, when a case that looks like one thing reveals itself to be something else entirely. When the grief on a widow's face stops reading as sorrow and starts reading as performance. When the phone records come back and the financial documents arrive and the witness sitting across the table from a detective begins to talk and the story that seemed, on its surface, so straightforward and so tragic, cracks open to show something far darker underneath. That moment came in Gwinnett County, Georgia, in the weeks following the death of Larry Tucker. And when it came, it changed everything. It was the kind of October evening that Georgia does beautifully, that particular softness in the air, summer finally releasing its grip, the sky going amber and then purple over the suburban subdivisions east of Atlanta. Larry Tucker was a familiar presence in Gwinnett County, a businessman who moved through his community with the easy confidence of a man who had built something he was proud of. He had plans that night, ordinary plans, the kind that anchor a life to its routines. He never made it to the end of them. Investigators and prosecutors would later lay out the sequence in court. Larry Tucker was shot and killed in what appeared, in those first terrible hours, to be a robbery gone wrong. It had the hallmarks, the suddenness of it, the apparent randomness, the way violent crime can descend on an ordinary life without warning or logic. Gwinnett County Police responded, and in the initial chaos of a fresh crime scene, the story seemed to tell itself. A robbery, a senseless killing, a community's worst fear made real, but detectives are trained above almost everything else to be skeptical of the story that tells itself. To understand what happened to Larry Tucker, you have to understand who he was. Described by those who knew him as hardworking and grounded, Larry had built a life in Gwinnett County that reflected the particular ambitions of that part of Georgia in the early 2000s. A place growing so fast you could almost hear it. New subdivisions rising out of red clay. Businesses opening along corridors that had been pasture a decade before. He was a businessman in that landscape. Someone who understood how opportunity worked and how to meet it. He had a circle, colleagues, friends, people who would remember him with genuine fondness. He had a life that felt, from the outside, like the kind of life a person works hard to build and harder to protect. He was married to Tracy Tucker. They had the material architecture of a successful life together. The house, the insurance policies that accumulate when you're planning for a future, the ordinary financial infrastructure of a couple who expected to keep going forward. What Larry Tucker did not know, the evidence would eventually show, was that someone had decided that future would not include him. The investigation that followed his death began, as homicide investigations always do, with the immediate circle. Detectives from the Gwinnett County Police Department started where the evidence was freshest and worked outward. They talked to neighbors, canvassed the area, looked for witnesses to what had been characterized as a robbery. And in those early days, Tracy Tucker presented herself as a grieving widow, shattered, disbelieving, a woman whose life had just been violently rearranged. Grief, of course, is not evidence of anything except grief. Investigators are careful about that, and they should be. But grief coexists with evidence, and evidence doesn't grieve. It simply is. The first threads began to loosen when detectives turned their attention to the financial landscape of the Tuckers' life together. Life insurance policies are not, in themselves, suspicious. They are what responsible people carry, what financial planners recommend, what couples purchase, because they believe the future is worth protecting. But the policies in this case were substantial. The payout Tracy Tucker stood to collect upon her husband's death was significant enough to give investigators pause, significant enough to ask the questions that always follow the money. Who benefits? Who knew? And when did they know it? Phone records came next. This is often where cases like this one begin to crystallize. The digital breadcrumbs of calls made and received, timestamps that place people in particular relationships at particular moments, the invisible architecture of a conspiracy rendered suddenly visible on a spreadsheet. What the records revealed, according to prosecutors, was a pattern of communication between Tracy Tucker and a former acquaintance that did not fit the narrative of a grieving wife with no prior knowledge of the crime. The calls were there. The timing of them was there, and the explanation for them would prove increasingly difficult for the defense to construct. Prosecutors argued that Tracy Tucker had not simply benefited from her husband's death. She had engineered it. According to the state's case as presented in Gwinnett County Superior Court, Tracy had recruited a former acquaintance to carry out the killing, offering what amounted to a hired contract on her husband's life in exchange for a share of the insurance payout that would follow. It was, in the language of Georgia law, a murder-for-hire scheme, a criminal conspiracy that transformed Larry Tucker's death from a tragedy into a premeditated act, carefully considered and deliberately executed. The person Tracy allegedly recruited became, in time, a crucial piece of the prosecution's architecture. Co-conspirators in cases like this occupy a particular position in the legal process. They often know exactly what happened because they were there, and their cooperation, or lack of it, can determine whether the full story ever surfaces. In this case, investigators worked methodically to develop their witnesses, to corroborate what they were being told against the physical and documentary evidence already in hand. This is the slow, unglamorous work of building a murder case. Each piece checked against every other piece, the story tested for consistency until it either holds or falls apart. This story held. Witness testimony proved to be among the most significant elements the prosecution would bring to trial. In court, the state presented accounts that described the planning and execution of the scheme, the conversations that took place, the arrangements that were made, the understanding between the parties about what was being paid for and what was expected in return. This testimony, prosecutors argued, was corroborated by the phone records and the financial evidence, creating an interlocking body of proof that placed Tracy Tucker at the center of a deliberate plan to kill her husband. Her alibi, constructed in those initial days, came apart under the pressure of that evidence. Prosecutors told the jury that the story Tracy had offered did not survive contact with the documented record. The calls that placed her in communication with the man who allegedly carried out the shooting, the financial arrangements that followed, the timeline that investigators had assembled with painstaking care over months of work. Tracy Tucker's defense maintained her innocence. Her attorneys worked to challenge the reliability of the witnesses against her. Cooperating witnesses, after all, have their own incentives, their own stakes in the outcome, and defense attorneys are entitled to point that out and often do so effectively. They raised questions about the sufficiency of the evidence, about the motivations of those who had agreed to testify against their client. These are the legitimate arguments of an adversarial system, and they received a full hearing. The jury weighed them and found them insufficient. Investigators had, by that stage, assembled a picture that prosecutors would describe as comprehensive. The financial motive, quantified and documented, the communications between Tracy Tucker and the man she had allegedly recruited, logged and timestamped, the witness accounts of planning and arrangement, and the fact of Larry Tucker's death, which sat at the center of the turning point, the moment the case shifted from a difficult investigation to an all but complete prosecution, came when the web of communication and conspiracy became impossible to attribute to coincidence. everything like the fixed point around which all other evidence orbited. When that evidence was presented in its totality, not as individual fragments but as an interconnected whole, it told a story that the prosecution argued admitted of only one reasonable conclusion: that Larry Tucker had been murdered, that his murder had been arranged by his wife, that the apparent robbery was a cover, a narrative designed to direct attention away from the person who had the most to gain. It is worth pausing here, as cases like this one always invite us to pause, to consider the specific cruelty of this kind of crime. Larry Tucker went out that October evening with no reason to suspect that the threat to his life had come from inside his own home, from someone who had made promises to him, who had built a life alongside him, who knew the precise contours of his financial worth because she was part of it. There is something particular about that betrayal, not more painful than other kinds of murder, but different in its intimacy, its calculation, its extended deception. He did not know. He could not have known. And the law would spend years making sure that fact was accounted for. The trial of Tracy Tucker in Gwinnett County Superior Court was, by any measure, a substantial proceeding. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which covered the case with consistent attention, reported on the evidence as it emerged, the witnesses as they testified, the arguments made by both sides in the kind of close-quarters legal combat that a murder trial always becomes. The courtroom in Lawrenceville saw the full weight of the state's case deployed against a defendant who maintained, through her attorneys, that she had not done what the prosecution said she had done. The jury did not agree with her. In 2007, Tracy Tucker was convicted by the jury of malice murder and criminal conspiracy. Malice murder in Georgia is among the most serious charges the criminal code carries. It requires the state to prove not just that a killing occurred, but that it was carried out with the deliberate intention to cause death, without justification or mitigation. The jury found that the state had met that burden. They found, in other words, that the evidence proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Tracy Tucker had intended for her husband to die, had arranged for someone to make that happen, and had done so in anticipation of collecting the insurance money his death would generate. The sentence was life in prison. Co-conspirators in the case were also convicted in related proceedings, the law holding each participant in the conspiracy accountable for their role in what had unfolded. This is how Georgia's conspiracy law operates. The agreement to commit the crime and the acts taken in furtherance of it bind the participants together in legal liability, even when one of them did not pull the trigger. Appeals followed, as they do in virtually every serious felony conviction in Georgia. Tracy Tucker's legal team pursued post-conviction relief through the appellate process, raising issues as they became available for review. The Georgia Court of Appeals examined the record. The arguments were heard and considered by the appellate judiciary. The conviction was upheld. As of the documented record, Tracy Tucker remains incarcerated, serving her life sentence in the Georgia Department of Corrections. The legal system, having worked through its processes at the trial level and on appeal, has reached its conclusions. Those conclusions have not changed. There is something that happens to a community when a case like this one emerges. Gwinnett County in 2004 was, as it remains, one of the most diverse and fastest-growing counties in the American South, a place of enormous ambition and motion, of families building towards something, of lives in progress. Larry Tucker was part of that fabric. His death, when it happened, registered as the kind of loss that any sudden violent death registers, a rupture, a gap where a person used to be. When the full picture emerged, when it became clear that the apparent robbery had been something else, something constructed rather than spontaneous, the community's grief acquired a new dimension. Not just the loss of a man, but the revelation of the means by which that loss had been engineered. These cases do something particular to the people who follow them, who live near them, who knew the victim or the accused. They complicate the intuitive story. They ask us to sit with the discomfort of knowing that harm can come dressed in familiarity, wearing the face of someone who said they loved you. Detectives who work murder-for-hire cases speak about this with a kind of weary regularity. The cases often begin with an obvious suspect, the spouse, the partner, the person with the financial motive and the intimate knowledge. And investigators will tell you that the obviousness of the suspect is not, on its own, evidence of anything. The work has to be done. The evidence has to be built. The alibi has to be examined and either confirmed or dismantled by documented fact, not by suspicion. In the Tucker case, the documented facts did the work. They usually do in the end. Larry Tucker was someone's son, someone's colleague, someone's neighbor in that sprawling, Kinetic County east of Atlanta. He was a man with a business and a future, and the ordinary human expectation that tomorrow would arrive more or less like today. He did not get that. What he got, instead, was the particular cruelty of a betrayal so deep it required years of investigation and a jury's verdict to fully account for. The jury gave him that accounting in 2007. The court upheld it, and in the records of Gwinnett County Superior Court, in the phone logs, the financial documents, the testimony of the witnesses who sat in that box and told what they knew, the story of what happened to Larry Tucker is preserved. Not complete, perhaps, in the way that human stories are never entirely complete, but documented, adjudicated, true. He deserved at least that much. Most victims do. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intellijix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.